Yeah, I am, as Sunit said, associate professor here in the college, but I'm not here in my academic guise. Academically, I'm a historian with specific expertise that I'm not going to go into or draw upon here at all, but rather to speak as a member of an organization of which I began as a student, and my career has advanced since then, but which is a student organization, one that I took part in founding some 6 years ago, and which has, much to my amazement, spread quite a bit, and we now have chapters not only in the city of Chicago, from which many people here have come, from other campuses, but also in New York, in Toronto, in Canada, in Boston, in London, in Frankfurt, and elsewhere in the world. And I'm also speaking as one of the lead organizers in a series of panels that I've helped put together with my colleagues and comrades in Platypus, including a member of this chapter, Watson Ladd, who helped a great deal putting things together. And we were thinking over the summer, with the waning of Occupy, that the question of the crisis really needed to be addressed. The crisis appeared in a particular form in 2008 with the and the election of Obama, but with the expression of the discontent with the Obama administration, with the recognition that clearly registered in this country that the Obama administration represented no real alternative to the growing inequalities and so forth that took the form very dramatically of the Occupy movement, which I'm sure you all recall from last fall. With the waning of that, we wanted to revisit this question of crisis and what does it really mean? What would it mean for it to end? And in what sense is it over already? Particularly now that Obama's been reelected, that the status quo in that sense has been reaffirmed, and there seems no real, there's no imminent expression on the left as to which way forward. And so I want to talk about the conception of this panel, but first of all to say that what we're doing here at the University of Chicago is the third in a series of panels that Platypus is putting on this topic internationally. First, it was done in New York City, and that took place on the 14th, and a number of a very well-known, almost entirely Marxist thinkers spoke at that event. Lauren Goldner, David Harvey, Andrew Kleinman, and Paul Manick. I invite you all to watch the video online that you can see of this.
I don't know if we could, someone could put up the email address,
media.platypus1917.org, or just 1917.org. And then on Saturday, we're going to have the second installment of this panel, not entirely Marxist, but more broadly representative of currents on the left, in London. And there, one of the premier theorists of the Occupy movement will be speaking, David Graeber, who teaches in London. Also, another anarchist, Saul Newman, will be speaking, together with a longtime Trotskyist thinker and editor of the journal Critique, Hillel Tikhon, and James Woodhuizen, who we might consider a communization theorist. So the Chicago panel is the culmination of this series. And here we have also representatives of the Marxian left, but also we'll have what we might call kind of a left liberal on the panel. And this represents our sense of our approach to the left in general, of trying to bring together the left, both in its political sectarian guise as well as its academic form, from in a sense all currents that derive from the revolutionary socialist tradition of the 19th century, all of whom we view as in crisis today. So that would include not only Marxism, though Marxism was the dominant expression by the late 19th century, but also anarchist and what we might call social democrat or New Dealist kind of left liberal currents. And so in Chicago, we have representing liberalism or kind of social democracy, the convener of the Chicago Political Economy Group, Joe Persky, as well as a philosopher from Loyola University who writes about market socialism, David Schweikart, who's a veteran of the 70s left. A kind of postmodernized Marxist, self-proclaimed postmodernized Marxist, and editor of a journal called Rethinking Marxism, David Ruccio, and lastly, a speaker from the Revolutionary Communist Party, Raymond Lotta, who's spoken on this campus before, a few years ago, for those of you who recall. Now, I want to, first of all, read out our event description to give you an idea of the kind of event that we intend to host on campus. And this is the same event description for all three panels, both London, New York, and Chicago. And Watson here is largely responsible for the drafting of this. The present moment is arguably one of unprecedented confusion on the left. The emergence of many new theoretical perspectives on Marxism, anarchism, and the left seem rather than signs of a newfound vitality, more the intellectual reflux of the left's final disintegration in history. As for the politics that still bothers to describe itself as leftist today, it seems no great merit that it is largely disconnected from the academic left's disputations over everything from imperialism to ecology. Perhaps nowhere are these symptoms more pronounced than around the subject of the economy. As Marxist economics has witnessed of late a flurry of recent works, many quite involved in their depth and complexity, recent activism around austerity, joblessness, and non-transparency, while quite creative in some respects, seems hesitant to oppose with anything but nostalgia for the past, the status quo mantra, there is no alternative. At a time when the United States has entered the most prolonged slump since the Great Depression, the European project founders on the shoals of debt and nationalism. If the once triumphant neoliberal project of free markets for free peoples seems utterly exhausted, the strange non-death of neoliberalism, as a recent book title has it, seems poised to carry on indefinitely. The need for a Marxist politics adequate to the crisis is as great as such politics is lacking. And 2011 now seems to be fast fading into the past. In Greece today, as elsewhere in Europe, existing left parties remain largely passive in the face of the crisis, eschewing radical solutions, if they even imagine such solutions to exist. In the United States, Occupy has vanished from the parks and streets, leaving only bitter grumbling where there once seemed to be creativity and open-ended potential. In Britain, in the 2011 London riots, rather than political protest, was trumpeted as the shafted generation's response to the crisis, overshadowing the police brutality that actually occasioned it. Finally, in the Arab world, where we are told the 2011 revolution is still afoot, it seems inconceivable that that revolution, even as it bears within it the hopes of millions, could alter the economic fate of any but a handful. While joblessness haunts billions worldwide, politicization of the issue seems chiefly the prerogative of the right. Meanwhile, the poor worldwide face relentless price rises in fuel and essential foodstuffs. The prospects for world revolution seem remote at best, even as bankers and fund managers lament democracy's failure to confront the crisis. In this sense, it seems plausible to argue that there is no crisis at all, but simply the latest stage in an ongoing social regression. What does it mean to say that we face a crisis, after all, when there is no real prospect that anything particularly is likely to change, at least not for the better? In this opaque historical moment, Platypus wants to raise some basic questions. Do we live in a crisis of capitalism today? And if so, of what sort? Political, economic, social? Why do seemingly sophisticated leftist understandings of the world appear unable to assist in the task of overcoming it? In the task of changing it? And conversely, can the world be thought intelligible without our capacity to self-consciously transform it through practice? Can leftist theoretical frameworks survive as economics or social theory or sociology or anything else without politics? Is there capitalism after socialism? Today, we wanted to kind of prepare the discussion, largely, the aim of tonight's session is to really get people thinking about questions that they can put to speakers who are professionally dedicated, lifelong dedicated to answering these questions, which I am not. This is why we've invited people who call themselves leftist economists, dying breed of people. But in order to get started on that, to kind of raise some crucial questions, I wanted to lead the discussion today around the writing of a professor who's on staff here, who was one of my mentors. Professor Moishe Stone. I don't know how many of you have actually read the piece that we suggested. If you have, raise your hand. Okay, I'm going to assume that you haven't. and make some very broad comments about the question of crisis that's raised in a piece that I would recommend that you read, Professor Fastone's Contemporary Historical Transformations Beyond Post-Industrial Theory and Neo-Marxism. And I want to do it without addressing the substance, really, of Fastone's argument in too great a detail. It's a massive, dense piece that it really defies quick summary, and instead to focus on the frame of the piece as a whole and to kind of raise questions as to how he puts the issue really should be jarring for us. And that is that the piece is an attempt to, in a sense, synthesize a more adequate way to think about the period after the decline of the welfare state in the First World, which we might call the post-Fordist period, or the neoliberal period, how to think about that through reading two major works of social theory, one Marxist and one non-Marxist, and grasping, in a sense, the strengths of these works and their limitations, trying to sort of rub them off of one another to generate a certain dialogue and potentially to point towards a more adequate way of understanding the post-Fordist world. He wrote this in 1999, and the two pieces that he addresses are both from the early 70s. Daniel Bell's Coming of Post-Industrial Society. Daniel Bell was a highly prominent American sociologist, sometimes associated with the New York intellectuals. So having some background in the left, coming out of Trotskyist circles in the city of New York in the 1930s, but ultimately becoming a mainstream liberal sociologist in the United States, and the leader of a tendency of international Trotskyism, in fact, the leader of the tendency that claimed to be the international, Ernest Mandel, in his book, Late Capitalism, from 1972. Why I say it's troubling that Moyse, or I should say Professor Fastone, in 1999 should read these works as informing potentially a more powerful or adequate way of thinking about the decline of the Keynesian welfare state world is that the period from the writing of those works to the writing of this essay is as long as really the high age of the welfare state itself was. Right. If the age of organized capitalism with welfare state economies led by American hegemony and associated with the domination of the United States globally in the Cold War really begins in 1949, with the Bretton Woods Conference, in which monetary arrangements and trade arrangements that are going to govern that world, if it really begins then, if that is the moment when the golden age of capitalism really takes off into the prosperity of the 1950s and 60s, giving rise to the last major upsurge of the left in the 20th century in the 1960s,
which was a left that imagined itself as largely expressing, in a sense, the discontent with that affluence, not with the immiseration traditionally associated with left movements. That if that period begins in 49 and ends in sometime in the early 70s, usually people date it to the oil crisis in 73, then the period between Moishe's article and the writing of these books is just as long. And this gets to what I just read out in terms of the question of whether the strange non-death of neoliberalism is poised to carry on indefinitely, and how we think about that. In other words, what are the presuppositions of Moishe's article, for all of its strength, is the idea that capitalism has taken a number of significantly different forms in history. Most obviously, for those of you who don't even have a, who don't have a strong grasp of history, still you'll know that the age of capitalism in the 19th century associated with individual capitalists owning factories in a free trade, liberal, competitive environment is the way that we generally understand the age of the rise of industrialism and especially British imperial world domination in the 19th century. And that this gave way in a kind of gradual way with the rise of socialism and certain welfare state provisions being put in place in the late 19th and early 20th century, but emphatically in the 1930s with the New Deal and fascist welfare states in Europe, to a very different corporatist, monopoly-centered, statist, whether Keynesian or Stalinist or fascist form of industrial society that had a very different character that generally goes under the rubric of Fordism, right? What we have to face, and what Platypus is certainly wanting to pose as a question, is whether our own time can really be understood as a kind of phase within an ongoing or unfolding capitalism, or whether it is better understood as an ongoing process of social regression and crisis, right? That what gave rise to the world of the 19th century and certainly the initial rise of the project of workers' states was leftist politics from the Russian Revolution, from the French Revolution to the Russian Revolution. And our period instead seems, in a sense, condemned to lament the passing of the welfare state. Its imagination seems to be preoccupied with the recovery of the welfare state, with the project of governing capitalism or controlling capitalism or regulating capitalism, making capitalism in some way respond to needs of people in the way that we imagine that it did at some time in the past, and that this is in a sense a project that forever is lost and consumed in the recapitulation of the failed politics of the 1960s and 70s, right? And this is something that we saw at the time when Moishe wrote this piece with the emergence of the anti-globalization movement and again in the anti-war movements and especially with Occupy, right? This growing sense of sort of decline within repetition. that we face. One of the forms that this takes is, you know, when the crisis first hit in 2008, people said, you know, well, in the face of crises, don't we abandon neoliberal economics and adopt Keynesian economics? But of course, they rapidly discovered that there is no such thing as Keynesian economics, and there are no Keynesian economists, really. That there is no technocratic response that can deal with this crisis, and that the so-called Keynesian welfare state itself emerged out of so radically different of a political environment, one characterized by a powerful labor movement with some form of left political leadership, that nothing of the sort, in a sense, existed in a toolbox of solutions, but that instead what we face is a kind of, you know, boundless horizon of the ongoing management of decline. In other words, that the best we hope for is a kind of Clinton-Obama type politics that will simply manage the ongoing degradation of society, the ongoing collapse into crisis, with no real illusions maintained about the transformability of our historical circumstances. So that's the kind of the broad frame that I would want to put Moishe's article in, is the, you know, the question that he's raising of, you know, what is our moment? Right, this is the last thing I wanted to say. I'm sorry that resolved to speak without notes. That's always tricky. The last thing I wanted to say is that this whole question of economics on the left is highly problematic. I'm sure that a lot of you have asked yourself, you know, is studying economics itself right-wing? Is economics a science, or is it an ideology of the ruling class? Right. Certainly around this campus, it would seem to be the latter. But really, one asks: is economics a science of policy making? And does the left make state policy in the manner of that can be imagined, for instance, in the relationship between a duly constituted academic discipline and the state? But economics has functioned on the left in a particular way, and in a way that's been very important for explaining to it what happened. And by this I mean, in the 1960s, and Professor Pistone characterizes this in terms of the thought of Daniel Bell. In the 1960s, it was thought that a post-industrial society was emerging that was characterized by the growth of knowledge economies and of a managerial class in which the professions, and engineers and scientists and doctors and healthcare professionals were going to become the dominant class in society. For those of you who care deeply about the history of the left, this comes out of a particular splinter within Trotskyism that manifests itself in the writings of James Burnham, highly influential on Daniel Bell, and that there's going to be an ongoing development of the productivity of the golden age of capitalism, of the managed society, of political control over the economy, and if you will, a kind of benevolent technocracy. Right? This is the way that most people imagined the future in the 1960s. Right? In the left, what happened was, with the failure of their movements in the 60s, many of them turned to Marxism. And they imagined that the revolution of the 1960s was going to be repeated in the 1970s or early 80s, just as the Russian Revolution of 1917 came on the heels of the Russian Revolution of 1905. So they imagined that the 60s was a kind of dress rehearsal for a radical transformation to come. And they were sadly disillusioned by the coming of Thatcher and Reagan and the collapse of the Soviet Union and a very different future than that which they had imagined in the late 1960s. Even though most of them imagined themselves to have become more radical in their politics, many of them came out of the 1960s seeking to deepen their leftism through a turn to Marxism. So there was a large return to Marxism in this country by 60s people who had been 60s radicals, so that the 1970s in some ways became the decade of the reconstitution of the Marxian left in the United States, but it also became the decade in which American organized labor, in which the seeds of the crushing of American organized labor are unmistakable. The decline of the very, in a sense, preconditions and rationality of leftist politics is manifest, all of which, of course, consolidates itself in the period in which I essentially became conscious of life, the 1980s, when the 60s, when the 60s left was clearly on the ropes and in collapse. Process that's now fully accomplished. So the economics was a way for people on the left, and it remains a way for people on the left to try to explain to themselves how they were blindsided by history. Right? How it was that the opportunities for radical social transformation, potentially even revolutionary social transformation, that they hoped would be the fruits of their political of the political radicalization of a generation coming out of the 60s and early 70s, how those were scuttled, how the left became, in a sense, the affair of cranks and subculture freaks, like myself, and those of us who try to cope with this fact consciously and rationally in Platypus, but nevertheless are aware of it. The left is gone as a social force. No one saw this coming, and so, you know, somehow capitalism did it, right? And it's that really lies behind the ongoing proliferation of books on the crisis, which people can never be sure, right? Is the 2008 crisis the continuation of 73, which at one level they want to view it as, and at another level they think, just let it be any other kind of crisis. Because the period from 1973 to 2008 is unbearable to think about politically. Right. So that's the kind of the broad terms that I'd want to open up discussion. Any questions or comments on what I had to say? Or the purpose of the panel? Or, you know, can pizza be passed? Or can
a little better what you mean when you said that the left is kind of dead as a political force? Like, in what sense were you construing the left? Like, the Marxist left, or just progressivism, you know, just leftist movements in general, like progressivism and liberalism?
I mean, I would simply say that, you know, coming out of the 19th century, there was a notion that human beings would gain progressively in their capacity not only to master nature, but also to master their social relations amongst themselves, to, in a sense, deal with their own interdependence with consciousness and deliberation, so that as a species on Earth, we would come to collectively and democratically determine our own future, rather than have history, so to speak, happen to us. And I think that, you know, now people just really don't believe that. I mean, a lot of what you'll hear in the university will tell you that that was a vast ideology of people who believed in providence or were quasi-metaphysical, that they believed that there was an end to history, which was mankind's, in a sense, pacification of its own social relations. But it was actually grounded in a very real understanding and reflection upon the revolutionary history coming out of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. It wasn't a kind of a delusion or a quasi-religious belief. And nobody believes that anymore. Nobody believes this anymore. No one believes. I always give the example of The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which was made into a movie. People can more readily imagine a return to cannibalism than they can imagine something as simple as the fulfillment of the Enlightenment Project of global democracy and peace. Really, you don't even have to explain to people what happens to turn us into cannibals, because they know it's an imminent potentiality of our present. I don't mean that like literally, like we're going to become cannibals, but that all sociality could devolve into, in a sense, what it already is, right? A desperate struggle of people against people, in which the privileged are in an aggressive way defending their what little bit of wealth and decency it can be mustered, and the rest are condemned. I mean, I think that I often read works of the 18th century with my students, and I always express to them how impossible the disposability of billions of human beings would be for the likes of a commonplace 18th century intellectual like Adam Smith to imagine. But we could go into real detail about the kind of the 20th century history of the death of the left. Yeah.
I guess I have the same question, but I didn't really get an answer to it. But what is your conception of, it sounds to me like your conception of the left is limited to the academic left and the political left, and that it doesn't include in your purview any kind of like social movement left or any other movements. And I'm wondering why that is, A, B, how, what the relationship should be between, in your view and Platypus's view, between the academic and political left, and the relationship between the academic and the social movement left. And also if this format of like a professor talking in a classroom, mm-hmm. is your model for that. And I think that...
I was actually thinking about opening up to other people responding, though I consider pedagogy to be important, and I know the difference between when I was a student and now, I also agree that that we should discuss, and there are a lot of people that have views on this matter. If anyone wants to talk about this, I think we should open up for further discussion. You know, to me, the question of a movement is, you know, the issue always becomes one of, you know, is the movement, I mean, you in a sense very cleanly divide between, you know, intellectuals, fine. Presumably intellectuals are part of the movement, or they're part of the political left. But more importantly, cleanly divide between movement people and social movements and politics. And I think that this actually is something the movement always poses for itself. Right? I don't know how, if you know what you think about this, if you participated, for instance, in Occupy, you know, the question of, you know, when you have large numbers of people coming together around a range of questions, right? When you come up against the limitations of in a sense issue politics, and you ask yourself, you know, what would it mean to translate a body of questions into minimally reform experiments in society? Immediately the issue becomes, are we the left wing of the Democratic Party? Or are we going to establish our own political party? But the question of politics and of power, you know, is something that movements come up against. I don't know how you think about that. I think there's a lot of ways to think about that.
Yeah, I guess I didn't mean that the social movement left doesn't have politics and that it doesn't have intellectuals.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that...
I didn't mean to apologize.
Yeah, but I think that also, like, I think it is a little bit of a too schematic that, as I'm posing it, but I think it's also, like, in a similar kind of schematization that you're using when you're talking about the left as in totem, or in as a totality, and I think that that's, and it seems like, you know, trying to break down what exactly you mean by the left, and how the different parts of the left should be relating to each other, if they are going to relate in a proper way. Or building a left.
Again, anyone want to join in? There are quite a few of us, and I'm not the only one with views on this matter. Yes, Ed.
I would just say briefly in response to your first question, it seems like we're trying to. The only way I can interpret this issue is whether there's sort of some part of the left out there that actually has a strategy with. Prospects for success, or if maybe there is some organization or some courage or some potential movement that might actually make history. But I think part of what Spencer was saying with the road example is that it's easier for us to imagine the end of the world than that the actually existing left will shape society simply. Whereas it's not clear that that was always the case. Like, say, during the time of the French Revolution or the Second International of Social Democracy, it seemed like there was actually a felt potential that the left could have a force on society. So that's all I would offer.
Watson.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to examine sort of, when we're talking about the left, the big difference between neoliberalism and the golden age of liberalism. If we're going to talk about liberalism as a 19th century industrial phenomenon, then it's instructive to note that that is a very real contestation of in the workers' movement against that, about sort of the possibilities it opens. It's impossible to imagine the history of the 19th century absent the workers' movement. Yet today, the period of neoliberalism, what's striking are two characteristics. The first is the way in which the history is very much not a product of the workers' movement. There, when Reagan and Thatcher, you know, Thatcher famously says there is no alternative, she's right. The the Labour Party was not offering an alternative. And the other big factor is the continued presence of the remains of the welfare state in a very real form, in the sense that the early, you know, the liberal period did not have the kind of welfare structure, did not have the kind of social safety net that today, in the age of neoliberalism, remains as a residue from the from Keynesianism, and that's without any sort of political defense of it being effectively mounted. And so I think when talking about the left, it's instructive to realize that